it was more interesting to have a sort of dialogue with the audience rather than a sort of one-to-one, did I do it right or wrong sort of interaction with the visitor. So if it became sort of too gamified, then I think it sort of lost some of the beauty of its autonomy.
Welcome to the next episode of the Creating New Spaces podcast. Apologies for the delay in releasing this particular episode. I've been in Japan for a while at an artist residency and also been working on interviews for another project and just haven't got back to this. In this podcast, I'm speaking with Harvey Moon from Spectre Studio about the making of Zephyr. Zephyr is an interactive space with a number of 3D origami objects respond to visitors' breaths and movements. Harvey's technical director at Spectre Studio and has his own art practice as well and has a really strong focus on kinetics work. Spectre Studio is a multidisciplinary collective that's based in Los Angeles. They make experiences that are meant to be shared. They work with experimental projects like Zephyr and also work for clients as well. In this interview, we explore what their process is and cover some insights and reflections on how they might have approached the prototyping differently in the project. We explore the nature of the interactions in the piece and how this makes for a shared experience for the viewers. We also discuss how the difference between Harvey's solo work and his collaborative work at the studio. Harvey, welcome to the Creating New Spaces podcast.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're going to get started by giving people a little bit of a sense of what it's of Zephyr. So what's it like to experience Zephyr?
Oh, Zephyr. So Zephyr was a kinetic experience, and it was really about the breath and how you might relate to your breath and how the breath sort of has its own, the earth has its own breath that sort of responds off of us as well. So as you walked into the space, and you'd approach the piece, it would sort of respond based on your physicality, your movement, and also your breath. And it would start reflecting and mimicking the visitors to the room. And over time, you'd sort of enter this meditative collaboration with the machine, breathing in a sort of meditative way and really reflecting on how the environment and your own breath have so much power and value that we should really value how all sorts of aspects of this planet have a sort of cadence and a flow. And we are just a small part of that enormous structure and environment.
So there's like this dual layer of what you're exploring of a person's breath, the reflection of that, and then the connection to a wider natural rhythms.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we were really thinking a lot about plant life and sort of a autonomous plant that might respond directly to the way that people are in the space and the way that plants will breathe in our CO2 and emit oxygen was a direct reflection of the way that we breathe in oxygen and emit CO2.
Mm. So can you just for the audience who might not have actually seen it at this particular moment, can you explain what's actually moving? Because I just nearly went to do that myself to fill that bit in.
Oh, sure. So each zephyr is a combination of 3D printing and origami that sort of sandwiches together. And when two motors work in combination, it can extend and open up these two halves, revealing a large sort of kinetic origami piece that would unfurl based on the distance of these enclosures. And so each of these zephyrs could autonomously move up and down and also expand and contract based on the different sensors in the space.
Cool. The, just interested in terms of the sensors as well, how are you sensing the breath? I can't quite tell from the video, by the way.
Yeah, so we had a number of, we were experimenting with a couple different things. We used a camera-based sensor for proximity and distance from different zephyrs in the space. And then we explored ways of trying to capture breath visually. There's a couple of different techniques that we've looked at about, looking for the vapor or looking for the the disturbances in the airwaves around people's visitors' mouths. We settled on a pretty simple CO2 sensor that as people were in the space, the CO2 would increase and that would change the activity of the Zephyr. So it was a more sort of, instead of a precise breath device for sensing, we actually just sensed a more like ambient experience of the space.
Okay, so this is one of those times when the piece is sort of responding rather than being interactive is probably one of the ways to think about it. There's things happening in the space and it reacts to those.
That's right. I always felt like it was more interesting to have a sort of dialogue with the audience rather than a sort of one-to-one, did I do it right or wrong sort of interaction with the visitor. So if it became sort of too gamified, then I think it sort of lost some of the beauty of its autonomy.
Mm, yeah, I always have this tension about whether or not you sort of have a binary action or whether or not you have this more ambient responsive. And I personally, as an audience member, really like the rest of the more ambient responses, maybe the way to think about it. How did you find that people responded to it?
I think most people found it pretty meditative. I think one of the things that we maybe shied on the documentation was how loud these motors ended up being in the space, which was a bit of an unintended side effect when you have, you know, 50 motors on the ceiling. We could have opted for a bit of a quieter mechanism. So that, you know, did a little bit to dictate how people experienced the space. And I think in the next prototype, we'll reconsider how the sound plays a bigger part in the way people experience it.
Okay. So the sound could actually become part of a rhythmic contemplative experience rather than, it sounds like it might not have been as controlled as what you wanted it to be.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty noisy in the end. And I think the intention was to be a little bit more relaxing and meditative. There was a lot of like spinning gears and moving things that, you know, we spent a lot of time engineering and building the kinetics that, you know, version 2 would be a bit of a different trajectory.
Just before we get into the process, where did the idea initially come from? Where did it sort of, what sparked it?
I'm not so sure. I think a lot of these ideas come a bit organically. You know, it's a bit of sketching. It's a bit of prototyping. You know, I imagine that this idea, I think it started with our collaborator, Dave Hull, who was exploring these origami forms and different ways that things could collapse and then reemerge. And just looking at the form, we had some thoughts about breath and lungs and plant life. And that sort of kept extending and kind of bouncing around and evolving until we settled on this idea of the Zephyr.
So it's possibly he was playing with these, and then as you started to understand and think about and contemplate what they were and what they could be, the piece grew from that particular moment?
Yeah, I think it's always fun to sort of let a lot of that go in the process and then let the piece tell you and teach you a bit after you've made some time and work into it. And I think it's, you know, a lot of people are sort of afraid to jump into a work, you know, it hasn't been fully fleshed out or realized or decided yet. We're a lot more in the phase that we can try things out. And then, you know, if it becomes a greater idea after prototype 1 or 2, then it's really can keep evolving and growing and adding together. And, you know, that's one of the incredible things is that the idea never really stops. It never really ends. You can just keep adding to it and expanding upon it.
It was, as you were talking before about the next version of it, that struck me as well, that moment if you start with something and you just keep on sort of moving along with it. Gee, interesting as well, by the way. Sometimes people think about the type of practice you're talking about as very plastic and very physical, which is not what gets associated with digital work. Is this a sort of common way for you to, for the collaboration to work and the studio to work?
Yeah, I think we've always been a lot more excited about the physical, about the kinetic and the mechanic, and it's really about building a space and an environment. That's really what we're most concerned about, is environment. You know, we're not thinking about the screen or a rectangle that things can exist on. It's more about how do we create a space where people can share in that environment, in that space, and share in that experience. So, you know, in that vein, we kind of steer away from AR and VR, which bring another screen closer to the face and sort of isolate an individual from the community, from the group. So, you know, whether it's kinetic or sculptural or projection mapping, it's really about how do we bring people together.
Bring people together and into a space to experience something together. Was this particular play with the origami shapes did turn into a piece? Do you quite often find that things don't turn into pieces?
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, if you could come to our studio, you'd see maybe like 10 or 15 things that are sitting around maybe at, you know, partial completion that we had experimented with and didn't get very far, or maybe it taught us something that we brought on to the next project, or, you know, there's lots of little prototypes and things around that, you know, just looking at my desk, it's full of them. There's a lot more unfinished projects than there are finished ones, and those have their own ideas. And, you know, that's sort of behind the scenes what people don't know, is that, you know, I wish I could finish all of the things that we start.
Yeah, I was talking to someone recently and they made the comment they're not very good at finishing things. But their work's incredibly experimental and quite complicated when they do finish it. And it's that moment, if you can't do everything, is maybe the best way to think about it, is another way to put it. Mm-hmm. So after you sort of started to get the idea, what was the next step after that?
Well, this was actually a pretty rapid project. So every few months, we try to get everyone together just for an internal project, just to see what we can put together. And this was one of those sort of, you know, moonshot experiments that we put together, sort of ruminating for a few months about with designs and sketches. And then we pulled the trigger and did it all in about 2 weekends. So there was a bit of prototyping while we were all together, but we would sort of decide very quickly on this would be the way it goes. And then we'd push forward. And, you know, that actually became one of our challenges, is that I think we've learned from there to really focus on one and really iterate a bit more and get it perfected before you scale up to 15. Because the scale of 15 to 20 of these items, each working independently and calibrating on their own and communicating, it became a bit more of a task to keep replicating that. And I think that was one of the biggest lessons, was that you want to focus on getting one to be really polished, and then we can start multiplying.
Yep. So you might have been able to get a better feel for, say, how the motors were sounding with that fully polished one before you started to scale. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. The studio is a collaborative process. How would you sort of, what's the words would you explain for, to sort of explain what that model is?
Well, I guess it's one we're always figuring out. We do commercial work. So a lot of interactive experiences and projection mapping, or, you know, a lot of real-time graphic is sort of our specialty. So wherever that can fit in a lot of different avenues, will come out and provide either consulting services all the way down to on-site, hands-on, you know, rigging up and projecting on walls. So really does depend on what the project is. We're fortunate enough to, you know, kind of pick and choose the clients that we really like to work with, and find projects that we find interesting and a little technically challenging and push us a little bit forward, and, you know, partners we like to work with. And then all of that work ends up feeding back into our artistic practice and the community events that we run here at Spectra. So really the potential of Spectra is to build a sustainable platform for artists that we can keep making our own work. We can work collaboratively. We can keep working, you know, using the space as our, you know, arts incubator, as well as doing the client projects that we need to keep the studio working.
And I think this is one of the really interesting things about this type of work and space is balancing out the possibilities of the commercial work as well as the actual artistic and creative work. And for me, it always feels like the better design work, commercial work, is actually done by the people who are actually also artists in the space at the moment as well, rather than people who are just doing it for straightforwardly entertainment all the time. So does that also mean that everyone in the team takes really sort of strong roles, like a classic design studio as well?
Well, I think it's a small group. So because of that, everyone has to wear multiple hats and kind of step in on different fronts. So I'm really not in the, I'm not looking for the strategy of pigeonholing each person into their own task and role. It's really going to be what you want to be doing and what you're most passionate about is going to be your best work, and trying to find a fit where everyone can contribute in their own way, while, you know, really loving what they're doing and loving being part of that team. So there's a lot of overlap. You know, there's never one person that's squarely responsible for anything. Everyone's sort of either a lead and has a backup, or a lead and has a team of two or three behind them that focuses on the task. So,
so you have your own practice as well, Harvey. How do you find that this process, this collaborative process, is different from when you're working alone?
I guess someone said if you work alone, you can sprint, but if you work together, you can go a lot farther. And I definitely agree with that. I think I tend to work on a project and just get really deep and intense into it. And it's such a, it becomes such a complicated structure that there's no one else that could ever peel away the complexity and understand what I'm doing. And in that front, I can just go deep and fast and build whatever I'm thinking about. And it's a really freeing experience to just, you know, follow that intuition of here's what I need to make next. But I would say there's a lot more, you know, longer term satisfaction of building something together and building something greater than you could on your own. And, you know, having something that you can really communicate through for months and months. You know, a lot of my personal work, I've had longer term projects, but it's usually a few months push for a show or for a specific project. And then, you know, that piece sort of exists in itself. But the collaborative work is ever evolving, and it can really continue to grow for years over and over.
Yeah, I love the idea of this metaphor of the sprint, that as an individual, you can sort of sprint and force and focus, but then as a team, you can actually run multiple marathons over a period of time. Mm-hmm. It's a really nice way of thinking about it, Harvey. It's interesting in terms of that. You've talked a little bit about what you've learned from the piece. Is there anything else you learned from it?
From Zephyr, I think I mentioned the few points, and I think we've learned from that is that we really want to get the polish figured out on a smaller prototype, spread out the prototyping, give it the time it deserves. Because especially kinetic works, you're going to really encounter a lot of things that you didn't expect to encounter. So we had to, you know, go back to the drawing board and multiply by 15 and get circuit boards redone and, you know, go over and over again. And I've really learned to kind of pace that a bit more and expect the time it's going to take to, you know, construct the pieces. And then you're not going to want to just skimp out on material. It saves you some cash up front, but it really causes you a lot more stress later on. So we've, you know, kind of pivoted to saying, okay, instead of us buying 15 of the motors because we can get them, let's really just focus on a few of the best motors we can get, prototype it, and then buy one more, and then expand slowly, building with confidence. That's a sort of a hard lesson to learn, because you really want to bite off these big projects. But you know, in the end, it's really upped our level of polish and the products what we could do.
Yeah, it's interesting balancing out the what you bite off and not bite off. I recently bit off something that was more complicated than what I normally do because it was in my hometown, so I didn't have to travel to do the install. And I got midway through it and just went, if I was in another city, I'd never be doing this piece. Yeah. And in actual fact, as I thought it through, the more refined version would have actually been more successful in many ways. So yeah, sometimes having those constraints actually improves our work. The question I like to ask as we start to wrap up is because as creatives, we're always excited about what we're doing now rather than what we've done in the past. What are you in the studio we're currently working on?
Oh, lots of things. We're working on a traveling exhibit that will be traveling between multiple cities coming up. I can't talk much more about that, but that's a very exciting, immersive experience. We just got in our demo space a pretty small but sizable projection dome. So preparing for a project coming up and doing some automatic calibration on the dome. So we were thinking about mounting that this week to the ceiling, figuring that out. And then a couple more kinetic works in the works. We have a new project coming out soon called Photon. And I'll keep you posted about that. But that is in the early prototyping stages. And that'll be another interesting kinetic light art.
Cool. Sounds like exciting. And having the dome in your demo space, it sounds like it's going to be fun.
Yeah, we are very excited.
Yeah. As a wrap-up, you possibly covered some of this already. As a wrap-up question, what's your greatest piece of advice for someone else thinking about this type of kinetic work?
If you're into kinetic work, I think there's a lot of really great resources available now that I didn't have when I was younger. There's so much you can learn about Arduino and kinetics and robotics, and 3D printing has really democratized access to stepper motors. And, you know, I used to have to pull apart old laser printers to find the parts that I needed. But it's a lot more accessible now with things like SparkFun and Adafruit that provide really amazing tutorials and guides on getting started with electronics. You know, for kinetic stuff, it takes a lot more practice and experience. You're going to need to learn the materiality of what you're working with. So you really are going to need to spend a lot of time practicing and finding the materials that you work best with. So, you know, I've seen kinetic artists work specifically with steel and build their own rigs. If you ever look up the artist Arthur Genson, who's an enormous inspiration, builds all of his own gear mechanisms with a jig that he built out of wood. So, you know, if you wanted to go that route, I use a lot of 3D printing. So learning how to 3D print objects and make kinetic mechanisms with 3D printing is extremely accessible these days. So find a material that you're really comfortable with and start practicing and experimenting and looking at guides. And, you know, it's a lot of fun.
Great. Thank you. That's a really great wrap up for the interview.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
As I've been thinking about this particular interview, there's some really great insights and just ways of thinking in this particular piece. When Harvey talks about how the senses work, and how the piece becomes sort of interactive with everyone in the space, it's a really lovely moment. He's talking about an interaction that isn't like a direct binary relationship. It's more ambient and more non-linear, quite often more like how we interact with nature. I didn't actually say this in the interview, but afterwards I sort of thought about the fact that this sort of interaction becomes a little bit like the piece is interacting with the weather of the space, and the weather of the space is created by the viewers. Like most of the interviews, we explore prototyping. Quite often, artists think about prototyping as a way of learning. Harvey actually just subtly switches this. He talks about what the piece can teach you. So it's this whole evolution of thinking about how the piece is evolving, where it might go, and what the essence of it might actually also be as well. Just a subtle shift in frame of mind. As I was editing the recording, I was struck that there was something in Harvey's wrap-up at the end that I found really profound, but it is really just a couple of words in a sentence. And this is the fact that if you're working with kinetic work or any sort of work that involves physicality, you just really need to understand the nature of the materials and really explore those. I think this is both about when you're working with physical things, but also spaces as well, to be able to really understand them before you start working with digital things and within with them or within them.